My wife and I had the privilege of spending the Pentecost weekend with the brethren in Southern Ontario and Western New York. We had been there about 4 years ago, so it was very nice for us to be able to get back and see the folks there, and had a very, very fine weekend with them a couple of weeks ago. After that, we decided that since we were so far back toward the east anyway, and it would be good to take just a few days of vacation, we decided to take a few days and go back to Washington, D.C. We've been there a number of years ago, but probably it's been over 30 years ago we'd been back there. And so we decided we'd take a few days and visit there. And it was truly worthwhile. It was very well spent time. We enjoyed a great deal. We visited a number of the museums and the monuments that are there at the nation's capital. Visited Arlington National Cemetery, and then spent a great deal of time down toward the National Mall, where many of the Smithsonian museums are. We went to see the African American Museum, which is the newest, or close to newest, the American Indian Museum, which is also very new, the Air and Space Museum, and then we also visited some other places, the National Archives, the Library of Congress, and spent almost a full day at what's called the Museum of the Bible, which was kind of an interesting presentation by itself. I've heard different reviews of it, and basically, I think they did a pretty good job. And it was well done. It was exactly what it says it is, a museum of the Bible. It was totally non-denominational, non-sectarian, non-doctrinal. It simply focused on the artifacts of what went into producing the Bible, the translation challenges, and some of those things that were there. And we found it to be really quite interesting and well worth the time to go and visit. We enjoyed the opportunity because, as we said, it had been quite a number of years since we were there. But there was one thing we really weren't prepared for, and that was there were thousands and thousands of young school children who were there. It's just about break time for the schools, and there were many, many, probably middle school age students who were there with teachers, with various educators, on trips to tour these various places. So everywhere we went, there were all of these young people, probably grades like 7 through 9, that period of time. Probably those, for the most part, who were older were working summer jobs. Those who were younger were a little too young to be away from home and their parents in the first place. But for those in those middle school years, this was a good time for them to come. And I say, I really admire those teachers and educators who serve as chaperones. Now, not because these are bad young people. I don't want to give that impression at all. They're fine young people. There are many good things about them. But it's certainly the middle school years are challenging years. And there are times that can really, I'm sure, push many of the chaperones just about to their limits. And yet, many of them were doing very, very well. We appreciated it. But as I said, we weren't really quite prepared for all of those young people to be there. The Air and Space Museum especially was basically chaos, as all of them were going all over the place and seeing all kinds of things and so on. But again, as we said, they were very fine young people, but I noticed something about them that wasn't necessarily all that good. And that was that in many cases, and again, I will qualify this as we go a little further, but in many cases, they were, it appeared, almost totally oblivious to the impact of their actions on the other people who were around. So you would try to walk down a sidewalk if there were many of them on it. They would be totally unaware that there's anybody trying to go by. If you were trying, for example, we rode the subway a great deal in Washington. That's, if you go there, by the way, that's the best thing to do. Don't take a car into downtown D.C. But doing that was fine. But we found on a number of occasions that when it came time for the doors to open, they would immediately charge in and take all the seats without any consideration of whether anybody else might need those seats at all. And they had a wonderful time with each other, and they were enjoying each other. In one of the museums, we noted that they literally were large groups of them sitting in front of the entrances to the restrooms, so that people who were trying to get in and out were having to step over them to do that. And yet they're totally unaware that they're having an impact upon others. Now, is that because they're bad people? No, I don't think so at all. I did find myself getting a bit irritated with their self-centered behavior. And then I found myself getting irritated with me for being irritated. Because after all, it's really not fair to be upset with somebody for something they've never been taught in the first place, and to be critical of them in that way. Now, I have to say that I've dealt with young people enough, both at camp and at FI, to know that this characteristic of being focused upon self with little consideration for others is really a very common characteristic in our society today, especially in the U.S. Millennials are often accused of that as that kind of thoughtless behavior, but to be fair, this is not a generational issue. This is not something that simply hits a certain group of people in that way. Being consumed with self-concern is not unique to a certain age group, but in fact, it is a hallmark of an age that we live in, and very often, it crosses generational boundaries. I think all of us have seen examples of selfishness all around us. Do you ever see, as you drive the highways of Houston, any kind of self-centered, me-first kind of driving? Now, maybe you don't here in Houston. Up in Dallas, we occasionally see that and have to deal with some of those things. As you hear the many stories of road rage, you find that, frankly, much of it relates back to this same kind of selfish way of thinking, that me first and nobody else should go ahead of me. One of the things that my wife used to find as she was working, thankfully she's not having to make that commute anymore, but she had people get very, very angry with her at times for things that she really hadn't done anything wrong. And yet that road rage is out there because people think of themselves as so very important. We see it all the time. Simple things like parking your car in front of an entry where other people have to walk around it instead of in a regular parking spot. Maybe parking in a handicapped spot when you're not handicapped. Just the laziness of refusing to put your shopping cart away when sometimes all you have to do is turn around and walk 5 feet and you can put it there. And yet people won't do it. People who litter. Isn't that also a form of selfish behavior? You ever walked across a parking lot and stepped in somebody's gum? Oh, that's always fun. Or how about those fine folks who walk their dogs but don't bother to pick up after them? I know in my neighborhood, I like to go out walking in the morning, and sometimes most of my neighbors, frankly, are very responsible, but all it takes is one or two, and you find that kind of self-centered behavior. Now, all of that seems pretty minor, doesn't it? I mean, why talk about it? Why is it worth a sermon about walking your dog and cleaning up afterward? But is it really minor? Or do those things, in fact, illustrate perhaps a bigger and more serious way of thinking? Realistically, we all know as well that, quite honestly, this isn't just a problem of those folks around us. But sometimes, even in the church, we likewise can come short the standard that we should have of being concerned for others. One of the most challenging things that I find in working with the FI students is, even though they're very, very fine students, trying to help them get the picture of the fact that they can't just operate as if they're in a place that just belongs to them. We have a break room, and it isn't your break room, it's ours. And you can't just leave uneaten food and dirty dishes sitting around figuring somebody else will clean up after you. Again, fine students, they're not bad people, they mean well, but that way of thinking, for whatever reason, hasn't been instilled in the way that we would like. There are many stories, even from local congregations too, where people unintentionally do things without really thinking. One of the stories I heard a number of years ago was, there was a particular activity, this was quite a number of years ago back east, where there was a combined church service. There were many people coming together, and it was going to be one of those things where they needed every seat. And right before services, in came a family with two children. Father, mother, two children. How do you find four seats together when all of them are pretty well taken up? They saw a gentleman sitting there who had two empty seats on each side. They said, sir, we need the four seats. Would you mind moving over and we can put them in there? And his response was, no. I got here early, so I didn't have to have anybody sitting beside me. So no, I don't want to. Now, I don't know exactly how they solved it. I know how I would solve it. I would put one child on each side of him. And, okay, but again, that's not necessarily the best way of thinking, but that's why they don't ask me to do those things. But I just simply, okay, here is, now isn't that a very thoughtless thing? Why would somebody do that when you know so there's a need? And yet, there was that approach. We all know that actually no one is born knowing how to be considerate of other people and their needs. That is a learned skill. And more than a learned skill, it is a learned attitude, a learned way of thinking. And if people aren't taught how to act in that way, it's not going to come about simply because we live a certain amount of time. Probably most of us can remember ways in which our parents tried to instill in us that kind of thinking as we grew up. I can think of many times when my father thumped me on the head and said, "Son, use that thing for more than a hat rack. Think ahead of time, recognize." And yes, he had to do that more than once. I wasn't always the wonderful, thoughtful person you see today. Have you ever been guilty of being selfish? Have you ever taken advantage of someone else because you just didn't take the time to consider the impact of what you've done? Has anyone ever looked at you and said something like, "Your mother doesn't work here," okay? The lesson that reminds us that we have to take care of ourselves. I was reminded just the other day of a situation that, you know, when you first get married, many times you've been living by yourself and you may not think about the impact that you might have on others. And I remember when my wife and I first got married, she was getting ready to do the laundry one day, and I told her, I said, "Well, you know, it's kind of been my habit through the years, you know, as I was growing up and so on, that I wear something and, okay, I can probably wear it again so I don't hang it back in the closet, but I just kind of put it on the doorknob on the back of the door, and you may want to check there when it comes time to do the laundry." And my lovely new bride looked at me and said, "I will wash your laundry, I will dry your laundry, I will fold it, I will iron it, I will put it away, but I will not go searching for it. If you want it washed, put it in the dirty clothes." Well, I thought about the deal that she was offering, and I agreed that was a pretty good one, actually. But, you know, it does illustrate the point of, I just really wasn't thinking. Yeah, why should she have to go searching for laundry to get it done? But I had to learn those lessons, and we all do. So probably the question for most of us is not really, have you been guilty, but how guilty have you been? Now I'll make this easier for all of you by answering first. I've been way too guilty way too often, and I need to learn how to change that. I thought one of the best ways for me to learn was to give you a sermon about it. And listen in as well, because I need it too. I began this message by talking about the young teens that we saw on the trip. But this sermon isn't about their behavior. It's about a way of thinking that is actually, seriously, a subtle reflection of the God of this world and his attempt to undermine what God is doing in you and me. It is important. Should we really be surprised that this approach is common in the culture that you and I are a part of? Probably a number of you are way ahead of me. You're already thinking about a scripture that in some senses was a prophecy of our age. But as you look at it, and we're going to look at it in a moment, you can be turning back to 2 Timothy 3. As we look at it, what we're going to see there, we've read it many, many times, we see it in a sense as a prophecy, and yet it isn't a prophecy. It's not like the Apostle Paul says, "I was asleep one night and God gave me this vision and told me to write this down." No. It's simply a matter of Paul looking at attitudes and approaches that exist in this human condition and saying, what's going to happen if we project this on into the future, especially as we approach the time of Christ's return? According to Paul, the underlying outlook that would characterize the final age would stem from an attitude of self-love. Now, is that something that should concern us? It's easy to live in the midst of a selfish society and see how people conduct themselves, But how does living in that kind of a society affect a Christian? Is there something that we could do to counteract that influence? How can we build godly love in a self-loving world? I'd like to notice, first of all, the introductory words, because they tell us something. Paul begins by saying in 2 Timothy 3, verse 1, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come." Now, we're going to spend a little bit of time here as we begin, looking at the entirety of this passage through the next few verses in some detail, because I think it's helpful. I think it's instructive as we look at this. But I also think it's important to notice the way Paul begins. He says, "Know this." The old King James says, "This know also." In other words, Paul sees the need to point out something here. He begins by telling us that it's going to be important for us to be aware of this. Since the brethren who compose the Church of God are going to be living in this age that he is about to describe, it's important for us to be aware of these characteristics. Apparently, it's possible for a person to live in the midst of this and not recognize what's going on or what the ultimate cause really is. Perhaps when you think about, and we won't take the time to go there today, but you think about the example of Lot in the city of Sodom and the example of Lot's wife. Perhaps that can tell us something about what it means to live in the midst of something and yet not really recognize what's going on around us. Now, I'm going to use a couple of times a term today, which probably many of you know, but I'll define it anyway just to be sure, because it comes from the German. The word is Zeitgeist. Zeitgeist comes from two German words, Zeit, which means time, and Geist, which means spirit. And essentially, we translate it as the spirit of the times. The Oxford Dictionary describes Zeitgeist, which is used in English, as the defining spirit or mood of a particular period of history, as shown by the ideas and beliefs of the time. Now, many of us have lived long enough that we know that the Zeitgeist of today is a very, very different one than what existed in times past. Many of you remember a time when there are many things that are accepted as common and normal today that are, in fact, would never have been accepted at times in the past. And yet today, it's almost like there's something wrong with you if you don't go along with it. It's very easy for us to assume that what we see around us is simply normal and therefore of no special concern for us. One of the reasons that we counsel prospective couples who are preparing for marriage about their what's called their family of origin is because we recognize that the impact of the normal, what seems normal to us, changes the way we relate to each other. Whatever kind of a family you grow up in, to a certain extent, that seems to you to be normal. If you grew up in a family where people didn't use good grammar, chances are you don't either, because it just sounds normal to say things the wrong way. If you grew up in a family where there was perhaps an absentee father or an uninvolved father, an overprotective mother, that just seems normal. People who grew up in a broken family, for them, very often it seems normal. Now, I don't mean they're sitting around saying, "Oh, yes, that's what I want to be." But there is just that sense that this is kind of the way normal people do things. I remember one particular couple, a very fine young couple in the church years ago, and they both came from church families, fine church families in many ways. And I remember in this particular case, the gentleman's father was an individual who was rather quiet. And when he came home from work, it was his custom to get the daily newspaper and sit down and read the newspaper while his wife finished up dinner, and then they would have dinner together. But he didn't really like being disturbed during that time. That was just kind of a winding down time. Well, when this young couple is dating, the young lady says, "You know, boy, that's something, I don't know that I could handle that. You come home from work and you just get real quiet and sit and read the paper. I really kind of want to visit with you when you come home from work." And the young man's saying, "Oh, no, I've seen that for years. I know, you know, I love my dad, but that's not really the best way to do things. No, I'm not going to do things that way. 6 months after they get married, he comes home from work, sits down with a paper, reads until dinner's ready. It just felt so normal. It's very easy for normal things to, because it just seems normal, for us not really to even question them. Now, of course, the good news I will say to this, too, is keep in mind, if you grew up in a loving, supportive family, that seems normal, too. And that can have a very powerful impact, as it should. So, what the apostle is about to describe is what will seem normal in the times leading up to Christ's return. And what seems normal often goes unquestioned. So let's take a few minutes to wade through this passage. The first portion is probably going to sound a bit negative, but I promise you that we will talk about how we can counteract these influences and as we go forward. But first of all, we need to get a little bit more of a detailed picture of what's being said. And I hope that in the process, as we go through this, we will each look at this and say, I wonder if some of that thinking could have slipped into my life. And maybe there's something there for me. So let's start here in verse 1. But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. Again, Paul wanted Timothy to understand the basic culture in which the church, ministers and members, would be living as the end time approached. It's the wisdom of an older minister being shared with a younger one. The term perilous is a difficult term to translate. The Greek term can be translated grievous, terrible, difficult, hard, something which causes trouble and hardship and implies violence, distressful times, dangerous times. William Barclay in his Daily Study Bible says this, "This word is used in Matthew 8:28 to describe the two demon-possessed men in Gergesa who met Jesus Christ among the tombs." If you read that passage in Matthew 8:28, it says they were fierce, angry. They were violent and dangerous. It's used in Plutarch, one of the Roman writers, to describe what we would call an ugly wound. Now, when you think about a wound that gets infected, remember through most of history, those who were wounded many times died from the infection rather than the wound. And that's even up into relatively recent history. I recently completed reading a book called Destiny of the Republic, which was about the assassination of James Garfield. And as you read through that, President Garfield did not die from the bullet wound. He died from the infection introduced by the doctors as they tried to treat the bullet wound. So this is relatively recent times throughout history. A wound that gets infected can be much more serious than the wound itself. So this word that's used here in the Greek was used to describe an ugly wound. It is used by ancient writers to describe what we would call a threatening situation. There is the idea of menace and of danger in this word. So it describes a period of time when there is this sense of menace and danger about mankind. So he begins by saying, "For men will be lovers of themselves." It's a fascinating word when you see this. Now, again, when it says men, it is the term that's used for mankind. It is not a term that means men as opposed to women. It means humans will be lovers of themselves. The word that's used here is philautoi. Now, we all know, again, that we've heard various Greek words that are used, phileia, as one of the primary words that's used to describe love. And the other word that's used here that makes this up is autos, which basically means self. Phileia is a word used to describe the love that comes from attraction and friendship. It's a perfectly fine word on its own and is one of the four fundamental Greek words that are used, that are translated as love. We are instructed to have phileia toward others. Even in the word philadelphia has that sense of love toward others. It's an attraction, it's an affection that we are, and we would hope we would have, even within the church, to a certain extent, though it's not the ultimate ideal we have, we would hope, I guess what we would say is, the kind of love, the agape love that we hear about, is one that chooses to love even when we're not lovable. But it also tells us, and we certainly are to have that for one another in the church, but we're also told that we're to have this phileia for one another. In other words, we not only ought to love one another because God tells us to, we ought to actually like each other. And that's kind of what philia is talking about, that we enjoy, that we appreciate one another. So that word has that sense. It is a love which pleases the person who gives it. The second word, autos, as we said, means self. And when it's added to philia, it changes the meaning to describe that which attracts or pleases the self. It talks about self-love. It's that which pleases us. One author put it, it is that which turns us on. It's that which we really like, which we enjoy, which we appreciate in that way. It is a love for what I want, without necessarily any true consideration for what anyone else might want or need. Probably the closest English word that we have is the word selfish. Webster's Unabridged Dictionary defines selfishness in this way: the quality or state of being selfish, exclusive regard to one's own interest or happiness, that supreme self-love or self-preference which leads a person to direct his purposes to the advancement of his own interest, power, or happiness without regarding those of others. It's not necessarily a matter of not liking other people. It's just simply a matter of being so consumed with what we want that we don't consider its impact upon others. Several of the commentaries say this, and I'll read the quote from Barclay: love of self is the basic sin from which all the others flow. The minute a man makes his own will the center of life, divine and human relationships are destroyed. We are told in 1 Corinthians 13:5 that love doesn't seek its own. It is the fulfillment of the law. Self-love always seeks its own, and it lies at the root of breaking the law. So all of the rest of what we see here is generally considered to be an outgrowth of this attitude of love of self. So let's look at some of these and see what they tell us. Lovers of money. This is not, there's something wrong with money, there's something wrong with wealth. Nothing wrong with that at all. And some of God's people are quite successful, and we're grateful for that. God has blessed us a great deal with faithful members who tithe and share of what they have to help out with the church. That's fine. But this isn't talking about having money. It's talking about loving it. It's talking about having a focus upon the acquiring of more. As one translation puts it, it is always wanting more, no matter what. I need more. I need more. I want more. This is my focus. So a love of self leads individuals to love money. Why? Because money provides what I want for myself. It provides for me. So I therefore love it because it provides me what I want. It uses the term boasters and the term proud. Now, we may look at that and say, well, what's the difference? Well, we'll see as we go a little bit here. William Barclay, again, is very helpful in talking about this. The word boasters is alazones, swaggerers, braggarts, false boasters. The Greek word alazon originally meant a wandering quack. In other words, a doctor who went from place to place and claimed that he could do all kinds of things that he can't really do. Thankfully, we don't have that anymore today, because quacks don't have to wander. They have the internet. And we have all kinds of things there that make all kinds of claims that we know and quite honestly are not true. But that was the Greek word. An individual who boasted about abilities and strengths, characteristics that he really doesn't have. What about the proud person? Well, it's described as a state of ostentatious pride or arrogance bordering on insolence. The Greek word comes from two words meaning to show oneself above. This person has a kind of contempt for everyone except himself. And I thought this, I've quoted this many times, but I think it's a wonderful quote from William Barclay as he looks at these two words. He says, the braggart is a swaggering creature who tries to bluster his way into power and eminence. No one can possibly mistake him. But the sin of the man who is arrogant is in his heart. He might even seem to be humble, but in his secret heart there is a contempt for everyone else. He nourishes an all-consuming, all-pervading pride, and in his heart there is a little altar which he bows down before himself. It describes some individuals quite well. And again, as I say, as we go through this, I think all of us have to look at this. And one of the things that I think helps us understand this is to say, okay, the person who is proud or arrogant isn't simply saying, look how wonderful I am, but they're looking down upon others. An attitude and approach toward others that is looking down upon them. Blasphemers. Well, we can say, oh, well, I'm not guilty of blasphemy. Well, in the Greek world, blasphemy basically had to do with speaking evil of someone, not necessarily God, as we use the term today. It could be about anybody. Other translations put it as abusive, railers, lovers of insult. Do you know anybody that way? We have comedians who made their entire career on the basis of insulting people. This is considered to be funny, if I can make fun of someone else. I have coupled in this, I didn't put it in as an official one here, but I have it in my notes, that I see in this a characteristic of an individual who tends to be sarcastic. Now, I'm really good at sarcasm, and I've learned through the years that sarcasm rarely produces a good result. But I'm really good at it. I mean, you know, when I get encounter some of those people who have no reason on earth to own a driver's license, I can get really sarcastic. But you know what? That's pretty close to being abusive, railing, and a lover of insult, someone who speaks evil. Disobedient to parents. Well, disobedience to parents here, how does that an aspect of self-love? Basically, it's putting your own desire ahead of those who've brought you into this world and want the very best for you. Now, of course, we could say, well, my parents are gone, so I don't have to worry about that. No, what about the things that they taught us? What about the values they gave us? How do I live? Unthankful. Well, if you love yourself, what have I got to be thankful for? I deserve it. How many commercials do you hear? Now, I'm a fan of advertising. I love good commercials. I will watch the Super Bowl. Well, actually, I will record the Super Bowl and fast forward through the game because it's usually boring, so I can watch the commercials. I really like good commercials. How many commercials have you seen that have as the theme, you deserve? And I watch that and I think, I do? I wonder what I did to deserve it. You deserve a break today. That seems pretty innocuous. But when I really look at my life, I think what I deserve is a slap up the side of the head today. But advertising tells me I deserve this car. I deserve the finest. Really? And if I think I deserve it, why am I thankful? Why would I be thankful for something like that? Unholy. These are individuals, basically the word describes people who refuse to respect that which is to be held holy, to be held apart, to be respected in special ways. Certainly it applies to respect for God. You may tie in, and I'm not turning back to it, but Psalm 10 and verse 4. I'll read it to you from the New International Version. New International, while we don't establish doctrine from it, is actually quite good in the Psalms and Proverbs. In Psalm 10, verse 4, in the New International, it says this, "In his pride, the wicked does not seek him. In all his thoughts, there is no room for God." Is that not a pretty good description of the world you and I are a part of? People live their lives and they have no room for God in their thoughts. It's everything else. As my wife and I toured all of those fascinating museums, the one thing that kept coming through is they were monuments to what man can do. And essentially, God wasn't there. You ever watch TED Talks? I like TED Talks. There's some really interesting ones. How often have you heard God mentioned? Everything in a TED Talk is about what we as humans can accomplish. So it's this way of thinking that leaves God out of the picture. Let's go on, verse 3, unloving. Well, if you love yourself, you're wrapped up in you, then why would I necessarily have love for other people? I'm concerned about me. It's actually an interesting word here. It's one of the four Greek words that are translated love. Based upon that, let's put it that way. The Greek word is storge, which refers to family love. the love that parents have toward children, children toward parents, that brothers and sisters toward one another. It's that kind of love. And this describes a people who don't even have a natural family love. They don't have that natural affection for one another. Unforgiving. Unforgiving can be translated as ruthless. And the sense of the word is someone who is implacable, someone who refuses to be at peace with someone else. They refuse to resolve difficulties and problems of that sort. It also implies individuals who break an agreement that they've already agreed to. Their word is untrustworthy. They say one thing, but you can't count on them for carrying it through. It also, in a sense, describes what has been called in our world today free-floating anger. Barclay calls it a word that describes a certain harshness of mind which separates a man from his fellow man in unrelenting bitterness. Some of you will remember that a number of years ago, and I can't even say how far back, I would guess we're looking into the 1970s, there was a great deal of research into what was called the type A personality, that individuals who tended to be very driving and so on had certain characteristics and impacts upon their lives. And as they studied it, they found that for many of those people, they tended to have heart attacks and heart problems rather early on. So the initial thought was, well, we need to be careful about being too motivated, too hard driving, and so on. But as they did the research a little bit further, they found that, as a matter of fact, it wasn't the driven kind of personality that was the problem. It was the driven personality that had with it this free-floating anger, this kind of individual that, as time goes by, they've got a short fuse, very quick to get upset about things. And again, we all see that out there on the highways. We, of course, are never guilty, but we see other people who sometimes have a really short fuse. You know, you see that person go by, and they make an obscene gesture at you, and you're thinking, why? What did I do? I just drove down the road. But there's that anger. I remember walking into a Kmart. This is one of the exclusive department stores that I shop at. And this was up in Ohio a number of years ago. And there was a fellow just exploding in rage at the high school girl who was checking him out. His problem was he bought a pair of jeans and he didn't think they should cost that much. So he is chewing her out. He is making a scene. Everybody in the store is looking at him. And you're thinking, she's a high school girl. She scanned it. That's it. She had nothing to do with the price. If you want to talk to somebody about the price, it's not her. But here was this rage that just came out all of a sudden. That's a very dangerous thing, but that's included in this term. Slanderers, people who are false accusers. Do we have anything like that in the world today? People who falsely accuse others? And it goes on to call it reveling in slander. People who love to hear these things, who love to spend their time looking at it. It talks about without self-control. Well, if you love yourself, why do I have to control me? My needs are most important, so I lack self-control. It uses an interesting term here, brutal, merciless, savage, fierce. It's, as it says here, a sense of being wild and untamed, a viciousness. It denotes, and again, this is a quote from Barclay, a savagery which has neither sensitiveness nor sympathy. Now, in thinking about this, I was thinking about, if you've ever tried to take an anonymous survey, you know, a number of years ago, and I will go back to United for this, we did a number of member surveys. Now, this is not a, please don't misunderstand, this is not intended to be a reflection on United. I'm talking about people, okay, not an organization. I'm talking just about people. But we did a number of those surveys, and as we were compiling people's comments, we asked a number of the local ladies in the Cincinnati area to come in and go over the results and to compile those things so that we could see what people were saying. And as time went by, we began to realize Those ladies would walk away from a day of compiling these things, and some of them are in tears. We say, well, what's going on? And we found out that some of the answers were so mean, so nasty, so brutal, that ultimately the person who was coordinating the surveys just said, okay, on some of these questions, I'll compile them and I won't even let the other people see them. In the church, because you can hide behind electronic anonymity, people would say some of the meanest, nastiest things. And again, I don't mean that as a reflection of United. I'm talking about people who live in a society. It describes here at the end of verse 3, despisers of good. Individuals who don't even have the ability to appreciate what is good. They not only don't love the good, they love the evil. It's not simply a lack of goodness. It is a despising and a disrespect for anything that's good. Verse 4, traitors, people who betray, individuals who cannot be relied upon. Headstrong, again, individuals who are headlong with passion, who want their own way regardless of what. Haughty, literally the term means swelled-headed or blinded with pride. Lovers of pleasure, fond of pleasures, given over to pleasures. For a person who is a lover of pleasures, or a culture that is a lover of pleasures, entertainment takes on an exaggerated importance. When people see little intrinsic value in work, in service, in learning, or in their relationships, then seeking personal pleasure becomes paramount. One who is a lover of pleasure has a lot of difficulty understanding the need to delay gratification. Look at our society today. How much role does entertainment play in the lives of most people today? You can't even mow your yard without being plugged into something. People are consumed with entertainment. Now again, does that affect us? Probably to some degree. How much, I'm not exactly sure. Years ago, I did a survey, actually here when I was in the Houston area, because the figures then and now are similar, that in the average home, the television is on 8.5 hours a day. Now, I don't know about your home, but somebody's taken up an awful lot of my time because it's sure not on 8.5 hours a day in our home. But we did a survey with the graduate club, I believe it was. Some of you may have been there and remember it. But I asked them to chart out every 15 minutes for an entire week what they were doing. And one of the things that I intended to point out was how much time was being wasted on something like television. What I found out is that, as a matter of fact, most of them weren't wasting much time. Most of them actually were using their time pretty well, and the television was a minimal part of their lives. So that's a good thing. But we do have to understand that when people are consumed with self, entertainment seems to be so much more important, and people will spend their time on things that really don't have any lasting value. They're just for the moment. He says they're lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. And then in verse 5, and this is the last verse I'm going to cover here, having a form of godliness but denying its power, from such people turn away. Individuals who go through an outward form, who have what we may today even call a secular righteousness. I want to be righteous. I want to be seen as a righteous person. But I don't really want to measure righteousness by God's standards. I want it to be by what I think. I think it's more righteous not to eat beef. Okay. God created it to be eaten, but okay, if you want to not eat it, that's up to you. It's your choice. God doesn't force you to. But to feel somehow righteous about that choice, it's judging by the wrong standard. These people have a form. They go through the motions, but they deny the real power of God's Spirit. Though Paul says this outlook, this way of thinking, this approach to life, this approach to relationships, is going to be rampant in the end time, it's actually been a part of man's thinking from the very beginning. Consider, and again, you don't have to turn back here, I'm just using one verse as an example. Genesis 4, verse 9. The Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" He said, "I don't know." Am I my brother's keeper? Is that not an expression of self-love? I love me. Why do you expect me to keep track of anybody else? I'm concerned for me. It goes to the very beginning. Now, when I began to put this message together, I tried to assemble all the pertinent scriptures about self-love and selfishness, and I ended up with 7 pages of scriptures. So obviously, no, we're not going to cover all those today. But it is an interesting study when you begin to go through it. Like many of the ministers, I've learned through the years that when I come up with a subject, probably the best thing to do is put all the scriptures together. And I often find that the scriptures lead me somewhere I hadn't planned on going. And that's a good thing. I'm wise if I go where they lead me instead of where I intended to go. So I will go through a few more today as we go forward. But it is an interesting study. I thought it would be helpful if we reference a few examples, but then I want to spend more time on what we can do to protect ourselves from becoming spiritually selfish. I think all of us can understand, in very brief terms, that an attitude of self-love has no place in the family of God. Therefore, those who are guided by self-love are going to be excluded from that family. That's one reason why the enemy wants us to think of self-love as normal. Because if we'll accept it as normal, then we really don't address it and try to overcome it. At the same time, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying about self-love. Some would conclude that the opposite of self-love is self-hate, and that is completely untrue. The opposite of self-love is love of God and love of neighbor. If a person loses that focus, he's going to automatically become a lover, or perhaps even a hater, of self, with all the problems and the sins that that kind of thinking is going to produce. When you read through the scriptural passages, you find that self-love produces a number of self-combinations as you look at them. And the book of Proverbs gives us several examples. I'm going to give 4 passages from Proverbs very quickly. Proverbs 14, verse 16. Proverbs 14, verse 16. A wise man fears and departs from evil. That is, he fears evil and departs from evil. But a fool rages and is self-confident. Okay, there's one of the things that self-love produces. I want my way. I insist on my way. I'm going to talk loudly and get my way. And I can be very confident that my way is right. But a wise man doesn't do that. Proverbs 18, verse 1. This is one you might not think of, but I thought it was kind of interesting how it says this. A man who isolates himself seeks his own desire. He rages against all wise judgment. In other words, here's an individual. I'm not talking about a person who, like me, tends to be a bit of an introvert, where at times you kind of appreciate a few moments alone. I'm not talking about that. But I'm talking about the individual who just separates himself from anybody who disagrees with him. And as a result of that, he's going to get what he wants. I saw a quote the other day that was talking about surveys, and it described 2 different kinds of people reading a survey. There's the person who, when they read the survey, if it agrees with them, then they say it's a wonderful survey. And if it disagrees with them, they say the survey is flawed. Okay, so you don't really have to take any input at all. I just separate myself from any other input, and I'm fine. I have family members, for example, who spend their entire day watching nothing but Fox News. Okay, you're going to have a certain perspective when you do that. You're going to isolate yourself, you're going to believe you're right, and you're going to make some really serious mistakes. Here's another one, which again, I hadn't really thought about in this way, but I think it's a fascinating statement about how God sees it. Proverbs 24, verse 11. Proverbs 24, 11. Deliver those who are drawn toward death, and hold back those stumbling to the slaughter. Okay, simple enough. You see someone who is headed for trouble, try to help them, try to head it off, try to help them. Okay, what does that have to do with this? We'll go to the next verse. If you say, surely we did not know this. Well, I didn't realize what was happening. It was, I mean, am I my brother's keeper? Is it my job to do this? Does not he who weighs the hearts consider it? He who keeps your soul, does he not know it? And will he not render to each man according to his deeds? In other words, to say, well, you know, I was busy and I didn't know what was going on. It's not my responsibility. And God says, really? I think it is. Proverbs 26, verse 12. We've all read this one. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him. In the field of education, we have a simple statement. The greatest barrier to learning is the idea that you already know. Because then we don't learn. Then we don't learn. We don't pursue it. As you go forward, there are other passages that include phrases like self-indulgence, self-righteousness, self-seeking, selfish ambition, self-willed. Each of those phrases gives us something to consider, both as we look at the world around us and as we look at the spiritual mirror to examine ourselves as well. If we're honest, we can probably all find ways in which we've allowed the normal thinking of today's world to lead us into varying levels of selfishness. I was especially fascinated by a passage in the book of Ezekiel that made a very powerful statement about how this could affect even those whom God has set aside to be participants in his plan. I never thought about this. I know I've read Ezekiel, but for some reason, this one escaped me. Ezekiel 34. And verse 17. Ezekiel 34, beginning in verse 17. He said, "And as for you, O my flock, thus says the Lord God, behold," that's an important word. Look at this. I want you to consider it. Focus your attention here. "I shall judge between sheep and sheep, between rams and goats." In other words, he says to his people who are his sheep, just being my sheep doesn't solve all the issues. I'm going to be looking at my sheep. "Is it too little for you to have eaten up the good pasture, that you must tread down with your feet the residue of your pasture, to have drunk of the clear waters, that you must foul the residue with your feet? And as for my flock, they eat what you've trampled with your feet. They drink what you fouled with your feet. Therefore, thus says the Lord God to them, behold, I myself will judge between the fat and the lean sheep. Because you have pushed them with side and shoulder, butted all the weak ones with your horns and scattered them abroad, therefore I will save my flock. And they shall no longer be a prey, and I will judge between sheep and sheep." So God tells us that he looks at us too to see how we conduct ourselves as we deal with one another, as we seek to be the people that God has called us to be. I always think back when I read something like this to the example years ago of the way we kept the Feast of Tabernacles. When I first started attending the feast, in those years, you were assigned a feast site. You could transfer. You could ask for a transfer. In many cases, that was fine. But when it came time for the feast, every church area was assigned duties that they would carry out at the feast. It wasn't a matter of whether you're going to serve at the feast. It was just a matter of where, what you were going to be doing. Everyone did something. And nowadays, many times people go to the feast and don't serve at all. And I cannot help but think, okay, what is the feast picture? Doesn't it picture a time when you and I are going to be serving all of those who've lived through and are a part of that age? Doesn't it make sense for us to be picturing what we're going to be doing during the Feast of Tabernacles instead of being served? God judges between sheep and sheep. Now, let me assume at this point that I have thoroughly convinced all of us that we need to be more vigilant about this zeitgeist of our world today, the spirit of our age. What do we do about it? How do we insulate ourselves from this way of thinking? How do we root out what may have already entered into our normal way of thinking and living? Again, I think you can pretty well understand, we don't need self-help thinking. We need scriptural thinking. So let's see what the scripture says. Let's look at just a few passages here, and we're almost done. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 24. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 24. Now, the context here is Paul is answering a question about food offered to idols. It starts in chapter 8, it runs through chapter 10, and he's talking about the way that we're supposed to think about the decisions that we make. And it isn't just a cut and dried thing. You have to stop and consider impact. So, as Paul is wrapping this up, he says in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 24, "Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being." Okay. So this tells me something that I can learn to do. That as I face different situations, whether I'm here at church or I'm dealing in my family or I'm out in the world, I'm even at work, that I have to stop and think about what impact does my action or lack of action have on other people? Think about it. Now, sometimes, realistically, okay, my house is on fire and my neighbor's house is on fire. Do I abandon my house and go help my neighbor? Bless you if you do. I hope you're my neighbor. But I'm saying, okay, yeah, sometimes there are things that I need to do too. And that's perfectly legitimate. It's not saying you don't have legitimate needs. But it says, it's not all about me. Sometimes I need to think about others as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, there are two passages in 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul is talking about a collection that was being made for the brethren who were going through what virtually was a famine in the area of Jerusalem and Judea. And they were in need. The brethren throughout the area of Asia Minor and Greece, Macedonia, were being asked to contribute to this. And Paul is talking here in this section about the brethren in Macedonia. Now, from what we understand, Macedonia was a very poor area in the first century. Probably the brethren in Macedonia, which includes Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, these are congregations that would have been in the first century world the equivalent of a third world country. Okay? We have brethren in third world countries, and we understand that many of them have their hearts very much in the work in the Church of God. So Paul is talking to about a group of people who would be very much like a congregation in a third world country. Notice what he says in verse 5 of 2 Corinthians 8. "And not only as we had hoped, but they first gave themselves to the Lord, and then to us by the will of God." In other words, their devotion was to serving God first. That's what was important to them. They gave themselves over, and they asked God to bless their ability to help those who were in need. And we are told from the passage that they were very abundant in what they gave. They didn't have much to give, but they gave abundantly from it. And God was pleased because, first of all, they dedicated themselves to God. A couple of chapters later, chapter 10, notice what Paul says here about individuals who, he's moved on from the Macedonian brethren, and he's talking about individuals who began to think of themselves more highly than they should. So he says this in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. He says, "For we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves, because they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise." What does this tell you and me? Well, if I begin to judge by the wrong standard, then I'm not going to really see what I need to see in my own life. I need to make sure that I'm looking at the right things. Let's look at one more here in Philippians chapter 2. Again, we've all read this passage, but it's a very clear passage about what we are to do. He has told us, and I didn't read verse 5 here, I didn't include it, though it's certainly appropriate, but starting in verse 3, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than himself." It's not a matter of I have to look at other people unrealistically. It's a matter of looking at others and realizing these are the people God has chosen. God's chosen these people to be a part of his family. He wants them to be in the resurrection. He wants them to be there when Jesus Christ returns. He wants them to be in his family forever. How should I view those individuals? He says, verse 4, "Let each of you look not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others." And again, verse 5, I don't really have to have it written here. "Let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus." That's the way you and I are to approach things. We're to approach things in that way. How do I take care of this? How do I help others? Now, I want to look at one more section before we wrap this up, but it's the section where we started. It's in 2 Timothy chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Because quite honestly, as we look through this, we will find examples here that can help us see what we can do to counteract this wrong attitude. Again, we start in verse 1. Know this, that in the last days perilous times will come, for men will be lovers themselves. And he begins to describe these things. Now, we can use any of these. I'm just going to briefly touch upon a few. But stop and think what these tell us. If these are the traits of an individual who is a lover of himself, then if I fight these traits, I try to do the opposite of what they say, then I'm learning not to be a lover of myself, but of others. As we move there toward the end of verse 2, we see the word unthankful. Okay, isn't that something that I can address in my life? Can I learn to be a thankful person? To be more appreciative for others? Whether I'm talking in my family, I'm talking at work, I'm talking when I go to out to eat, I mean, those people who are serving my table, who are bringing me the food, shouldn't I be thankful to them? Well, they're being paid to do that. Yes, they are, and I can still be thankful. Can I be thankful in my own family? Can I be thankful for things in those ways? Can I remind myself, day after day, moment after moment, I need to not only think thankfulness, I need to express it. I need to tell people, thank you. I really appreciate what you've done. That's a way to balance, to fight against that wrong spirit. He says in verse 3, unforgiving. Are there things that I have not forgiven? Things that I fail to forgive? Slanderers. Are there things that I say I shouldn't say? Now again, I know the question is not, do you ever say anything you shouldn't say? The question for all of us is, how often do we do it, and what do we do about it when we do? Do we straighten it out? Do we refrain from saying those wrong things? Without self-control. Well, self-control is so hard to build. Yeah, but it's absolutely essential. Now, I want to share with you a story. I think I have a moment here. I want to share with you a story. Many of you will probably remember. It's one of my favorite stories from Mr. Selmer Hegvold. Some of you remember Mr. Hegvold. He's a wonderful man. Used to work with the deaf people and so on. Mr. Hegvold grew up on a farm and developed, shall we say, a very colorful vocabulary. And then he went into the Army in World War II. And, of course, the Army obviously helps you develop that vocabulary even more. And after a period of time coming out of the Army, he worked as a cabinet maker. He was an excellent woodworker. But he had this terrible mouth. He'd just get angry and say all kinds of terrible things. And about that time, he began to hear this person on the radio. And he began to listen. And he began to realize, I can't keep doing this. And it really bothered him. And he struggled against it, and yet every time something happened, the words just came pouring out of his mouth. And he struggled and struggled. He even fasted about it. Before coming into the church, he fasted about it, struggled with it. He was at work one day, he said, and he was making something, and he was pounding a nail. And instead of hitting the nail, he hit the nail and just smashed his thumb. And he grabbed his thumb. He said he ran around the shop. He climbed up on his work table. He climbed down. He ran into the restroom. And all of a sudden it struck him. He hadn't said anything. The words hadn't come out of his mouth. He literally got down and prayed in the restroom to thank God. Now, he said, it's years before they didn't come to my mind. But it was the process of working at it, working at it, working at it. And ultimately, yeah, they didn't come to his mind either. It takes time to develop self-control, but we can. We can look at the other words. Verse 4, traitors. Am I a faithful person to my word? Headstrong. Do I demand my way? Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Do I put too much emphasis on pleasure in my life? If so, those are things I can change. Those are not outside of my control. I have the ability to make those changes. Sometimes the most important aspect of addressing a problem is being able to recognize it in the first place. When we see the problem, how it manifests itself in the varied areas of life, in society, in our family, even in the church, it becomes easier for us to take the steps that enable us to become the people God has called us to become. To be fair and realistic, I really don't think my selfishness is going to magically disappear because I've given you this sermon. I have to do some things just like anybody else in order to address those problems. But it helps me to focus on the problem and the solutions, and I hope it's helpful to you in that way too. It's important for all of us who live in a world characterized by self-love, with all of the destructive fruit that that produces, that we begin to take the steps that can help us root out that wrong thinking and ingrain the right godly way of thinking and living in our lives. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. Look forward to visiting as we have a little bit of time afterwards and being able to catch up on old friendships as well.